in Hollywood and in the industry and the stuff we do, there's a lot of like insider secrets to keeping your career going.
Martin Lawrence is the guy that showed everybody you can make it from DC to Hollywood. So let me ask you this. What is happening in Hollywood that a guy that tough will be on the street waving a gun, screaming, they are trying to kill me?
Yeah.
What's going on? Why is Dave Chappelle going to Africa? Why does Mariah Carey make a $100 million deal and take clothes off on TRL? A weak person cannot get to sit here and talk to you. Ain't no weak people talking to you. So what is happening in Hollywood? Nobody knows. The worst thing to call somebody is crazy, is dismissive. I don't understand this person, so they're crazy. That's bullshit. These people are not crazy, they're strong people. Maybe the environment is a little sick. I'm dropping dimes tonight.
You know, there's a lot of good people in this industry, but there's also a lot of really, really sick, corrupt people in this industry. And there are people in this industry who have gotten away with it for so long that they feel they're above the law. And that's got to stop. Let me tell you about a little situation. It's been testing my patience, man. She was keeping me up all night.
Once you are in, they prefer you not to hang around nobody you know. Why? Because people that's not in the industry can see BS. They can see demonic things happening. They don't want you around folks like that because they can influence you to get out.
What about my family? What about my friends? Wait, whatever happened to my friends? Damn, I don't even have any friends.
And they hate looking in the mirror. The only time they look in the mirror is when a stylist come over. They don't even comb their hair until the stylist come over.
When you look in the mirror now and the image that looks back at you, do you, are there days when you say, well, I kind of like this, or I like
today? I'm never,
I think I'm pretty cute today?
No, I try not to look in the mirror. I really do, because I'm never happy with what I see. So I go on with my work and get it done.
I have to ask you this. So many mothers in my audience have said, to please ask you this question.
Yeah.
Why do you always grab your crotch?
The epitome of trauma-based mind control. As a matter of fact, it can be used as a handbook for trauma-based mind control. And that's the movie, The Butterfly Effect.
Yes.
And I find it very unique because in Aleister Crowley's work on The Moonchild, he called that book in a subtitle, The Butterfly Net.
Yes.
When you watch The Butterfly Effect with Ashton Kutcher, who also is a major catalyst, you know, married Demi Moore, catalyst wedding, all of that good stuff. Every part of the trauma-based mind control, from pedophilia to killing the pet, to even the unusual side effects that these trauma-based victims report, which is this bilocation and even time dilation.
Yes.
And all of that that the character goes through. And anyone that wrote The Butterfly Effect has a deep, deep-seated knowledge into trauma-based mind control.
Yeah.
And Monarch programming.
Grabbed her the hair clipper and started doing it herself.
Bradley, did she say why? I mean, did she offer any information?
They asked why she wanted to shave her head, and she said, I don't want anyone touching me. I'm tired of everybody touching me.
Certainly is a different look for Britney Spears, Mark and Michelle. With me now is Emily Wynn Hughes. Emily, you were inside the tattoo parlor when Britney arrived and got her tattoo, and you asked her why she shaved her head. What did she say?
She basically just said that she was tired of having things plugged into it, and she didn't want anybody to touch her, tired of people touching her, that sort of thing. It seemed like she was kind of sick of it all, whatever it all is.
Roman is a crazy boy who lives in me, and he says the things that I don't want to say. He was born, you know, just a few months ago. I think he was born out of rage. He was conceived in rage. So he bashes everyone. He threatens to beat people, and he's violent.
That must be nice to have, like, an ignorant loudmouth who you can just sort of blame every...
He wants to be blamed. I don't want to blame him. I ask him to leave, but he can't. He's here for a reason. People have brought him out. People conjured him up. Now he won't leave.
I've entertained, I've pleased your children, I've pleased your wives, I've pleased you, you sons of bitches!
Everybody in this world should have the freedom of choice.
And child stars don't.
Child stars have nothing. They have nothing, they have no choice. I was never taught how to have a family. I was never taught how to raise a child because I wasn't raised properly. I was never taught how to care for somebody because I was never shown genuine love. I was shown business. This is what you do. Here's how you read a contract. I knew how to read a contract by 10 years old, but I didn't know what it meant for somebody to come in and tell me they love me and kiss me goodnight. That's a problem.
Shia LaBeouf isn't exactly a household name yet, but he will be soon, trust me. Perhaps best known for his Emmy Award-winning role as Louis Stevens of the Disney Channel's Even Stevens, LaBeouf is also making a big splash on the big screen. He's currently starring in Holes, opposite Sigourney Weaver and John Voight, and will also be appearing in some of this summer's biggest blockbusters. The talented young actor also highlighted in Vanity Fair's July issue. Shia, good morning to you.
Good morning, sir.
You are on fire. Three movies this summer.
I don't know what's going on, man.
What are you
going
to do this summer? Just take it off and rest?
I don't know. It's tough. It's like I seem to be safer in my life when I'm working, and it just makes everything better. You know what I mean?
I feel the same way about my teenagers, by the way. Keep them moving. They stay out of trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you have never had a formal acting lesson.
Not really. No. Just sort of jumped in, and everything started working, and like I booked my first three auditions, and it just stumbled and happened. And I swear to God, this all just happened. Yes, there's no catching up to
you. Celebrities live their lives seeking the adoration of their fans. And because they are so insecure and narcissistic, they need to know that they're getting that love from the fans.
You wore a paper bag on your head that said you weren't famous anymore or something like that?
Yeah.
That you were no longer... And that was at a red carpet event?
For Nymphomaniac, yeah.
Uh-huh, okay. So you wore that.
Yeah.
All right. And then, to apologize, then you did a performance piece, which that sort of was, but you did a performance art piece where people could come and see you and sit and do and say whatever they wanted to you.
Yeah, and we had like a table with all these implements. You know, there was like an Indiana Jones whip and some pliers and...
What?
Yeah, it was like, sort of no rules.
Like, yeah. If people wanted to use those things on you?
Yeah, because there was a lot of, like, negativity online. So I thought, all right, well, let's just, you know, let's see what this negativity is about. And I was sitting in there broken, you know. I was really, truly apologetic. So I was sort of, like, apologizing to the public in a way. And so I thought, for sure, people are going to come in and be super mean. Because it's what I had been reading. But it wasn't that way at all. It was very human. Once they got in there, everything changed. Mm-hmm. You know? They stopped looking at me as, like, an object. They start looking at me as, like, a human.
You were shaking your head vigorously when I was talking to Todd about being Hollywood's dirty little secret. Do you think it is?
I do think it is.
It's not necessary for us to stir up that hornet's nest unless we intend to get stung a million times. I didn't understand that. They had to sting me a million times.
Oscar-winning director Roman Polanski is fighting hard this morning to keep from being extradited to the United States. A Hollywood fugitive had been hiding in plain sight for three decades, but was finally arrested over the weekend.
The transatlantic struggle over the fate of Roman Polanski is escalating this morning as both France and Poland say they will press Switzerland for his release and say they plan to appeal to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to have the charges set aside.
In 1977, Polanski plied a 13-year-old girl with champagne and drugs and then raped her, a charge reduced to a single count of unlawful sexual intercourse, which he pled guilty to.
Let's tarnish their good name, let's belittle them, let's diminish the worth of their value, so that eventually, if they ever actually decide to come forth and speak the truth, nobody will believe them because they're a joke and they're washed up. That's the trick of the system.
It's something so real, in contrast to what Hollywood is, a very powerful illusion.
In Hollywood and in the industry and the stuff we do, there's a lot of, like, insider secrets to keeping your career going.
I guess there's no catching.
when I wake up in the morning and the alarm gets out of warning. I don't think I'll ever make it on time. By the time I grab my books and I give myself a look, I'm at the corner just in time to see the bus fly by. It's alright, cause I'm safe out of jail. If the teacher pops a...
This is a big night.
Big night.
We've all been looking forward to this, and you have been teasing the Facebook group for weeks amazing art.
The tease is part of the process.
That's right.
I think.
But now we're going to pay it off.
You know, I was saying before we started, shows often start, you guys probably all have had this experience, or both of you, Stephanie and Brian. A show starts out, and it feels like a fairly clean path from beginning through middle to end.
Mm-hmm.
And this feels like entering that maze in The Shining, this show.
That's a clever lead in there.
Yeah. Or an ant farm where you don't know if you're just going to wind up at a dead end.
Yeah. Or it's all just shifting sands. Yeah.
Shifting. Oh, yeah, shifting sands. Nice. I thought we could just start with who each of us are.
That's a good idea. Because some people are hearing this for the first time without having heard any of the previous Conspirathons.
Which isn't wise, I don't think. But, you know, if you're already here, we'll try to provide you with enough information to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we did our first Conspirathon back in August of 2015. It was a tremendous success, and everybody's been, or a lot of people anyway, have been asking for more since then. And this is the original team. So I'm Brad. I'm the host of the School Sucks podcast. Stephanie?
Yep. Hi, I'm Stephanie Murphy. And I'm a recovering conspiracy addict. No, I'm just kidding.
You're just getting started.
Yeah.
I totally am. I actually don't know very much about conspiracies, and I haven't seen all of the movies that we're going to discuss on this part of Conspirathon. So my role here, I think, is going to be just mostly asking questions. I am certainly not claiming to be any kind of expert on conspiracies. I'm a voice actor and a talk show host. You might have heard me on Sex and Science Hour or on Let's Talk Bitcoin or on various other shows I've been on in the past,
mm-hmm.
or doing audiobooks on audible.com.
Indeed. Brian?
Yeah. And I am Brian Sovryn. That's S-O-V-R-Y-N. You might have heard me as Stephanie's co-host on Sex and Science Hour, but my most infamous role is as the host of Sovryn Tech. And you can find, I do tons of work. You can find it all at zog.ninja. That's the website.
Brian and I are partners in podcasts and in life, in case you're wondering. We get questions about that sometimes when we do shows together.
Mm-hmm.
Like people say, oh my God, I think they're like flirting with each other. And well, yeah, we're together. We've been going out for like 4 years. So.
Yeah, somehow they missed that.
Well, it's great to have you guys back on the show. And this is a massive undertaking. I thought we'd be doing ourselves a favor by kind of lasering in just on the entertainment industry in
right.
this world of conspiracy theory. No.
Nope.
This is such a huge project. And we do this for fun. I can't believe how much research I've done compared to how many answers I actually have. But
right.
like we talked about before, these kinds of investigations are really good critical thinking exercises. They're really good learning experiences in terms of history and psychology. So I think this is worthwhile work in addition to its potentially tremendous entertainment value.
Very
absolutely.
Fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm in it for, the fun.
Yeah. I started to think, like, to provide value, this first hour of the thon should really be about setting a stage and talking about maybe what some of our goals are. This is focusing on I called it the silver screen edition, but Hollywood more generally. So that could involve the film industry, the Hollywood culture, television, even the music industry might come into it.
Pop culture overall, yeah.
Yeah. Who's contributing to it? Who's affecting it? Is anyone controlling it?
Who started it?
Who started it?
That's a good question.
When it comes to Hollywood, that is one that the Jews did do.
Yes.
And that will be part of our story today. But yeah, I think the history of what we're going to be examining, followed by an introduction to the groups that are accused of controlling everything or using this media as mind control.
Sure.
Even. And then maybe some of the symbols frequently occurring in these forms of media.
Yeah, and I think the symbols are really important to bring up because I think as we'll discover when we discuss it, the names seem to change. The accusations, you know, the fingers get pointed elsewhere at various points, but mm-hmm. it does seem like the symbolism stays the same. And so I think that's an important aspect to cover as well when, you know, as we go down this road.
And speaking of finger pointing, Brian also brought a really interesting thing that maybe we could start out with even that breaks, you know, just the idea of conspiracies into five different basic types of conspiracies. I keep wanting to say conspirathons.
It just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. Conspirathon. Do you guys want to talk about the five basic types of conspiracies?
Yeah, I'm eager to hear what they are, Brian.
Yeah, it's really sure. interesting.
Yeah, so this comes from, there's a great guy, his name's Jesse Walker. He's written a couple of books. One of them is called The United States of Paranoia. And for the purposes of this conversation, that's the more important. The other one was called Rebels on the Air. It was about the history of radio, which is still a fascinating read. So anything by Jesse Walker, you can check out. But he broke it down into five different categories, and granted, any conspiracy that you think of could change over time to become a different part, or like could change to into
change
any one of the five,
jump
or even, you know, more than one of the categories could kind of come together. The first one is what's called the enemy outside. And this is the enemy outside is the idea of you have a community of like-minded people, and then this is the ultimate us versus them. There is a them on the outside of this mental, outside of this community that thinks in a certain way. And this outsider group is trying to get into the community, and they are trying to, make them like the outsiders, make the insiders like the outsiders. That's the idea.
For example, the Muslim immigrants are coming to America and they're going to change our way of life. Politically liberal immigrants are coming and they're going to vote Democrat and change our way of life.
Well, that's been a concern for a long time.
Sure.
And people might even say, well, it depends on whether you're talking about what group of immigrants, but...
Well, like more general than that, any group of immigrants throughout history, it's always an outsider versus insider kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it is something that's been around for a long time. There's the idea of what's called the super chief, which is really, one of the, at least in the United States, one of the original conspiracy theories. The super chief is people like Geronimo and all these others, in the modern version would be like Osama bin Laden, which is this one guy that has way more power, or is claimed to have way more power than they could possibly have.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of conspiracy theories in the United States all started with the idea, hey, the Indians are coming. They're going to take your daughters. They're going to do this and all these things. And that is one of those cases where it's the enemy outside. The whole clash of civilizations, like Samuel P. Huntington talked about in his seminal work in the 90s, all of that is the enemy outside. That is a type of conspiracy theory, but honestly, that's really commonplace for a lot of people to think that way. And it's really a big part of the narrative that I think a lot of people are sold through mass media today.
Yeah, I think that talking about it as a conspiracy, in certain cases, I'm sympathetic to people who have it as a concern, but as a kind of organized conspiracy, or some mass invading group, I don't really buy into that. And if you're saying that the super chief is maybe a way to simplify that,
yes,
in people's minds, like they're all being directed here by this one guy,
right?
That makes sense.
It makes me think of back in like 2008, maybe when I was still paying attention to politics, mm-hmm. which I don't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember there were groups of people in New Hampshire involved in maybe Republican circles or mm-hmm. even libertarian circles who were saying that there was a concerted, organized effort to bus people in to like college towns where it's easy to register to vote for people who don't really necessarily live there or don't live there full time and have them vote Democrat. It was a concerted, organized thing. We were talking before about maybe theories on a larger scale. I would say that's more of a conspiracy theory, right? Because it's happening on a smaller scale, and it's like there's possibly a group of people who's organizing to pull this off.
Oh, yeah. That's actually really common in New Hampshire and
sure.
in more conservative states that mm-hmm. happens.
So, I mean, and when we say conspiracy theory or conspiracy, that often maybe carries the connotation of, oh, this is crazy. This is really true. This is just paranoid people making it up. But Not necessarily, right? A conspiracy is just a group of people conspiring to do something, right?
Yeah,
right,
I mean, that really happens. I mean, everybody knows in Washington, D.C. today, you know, there's backroom deals. There's groups of, you know, certain politicians that go over here, they talk and they, you know, they get together and they make something happen. I mean, these things are real. Of course, you know, what the breadth of the effect of what they converse about, that's what's up to debate. But I mean, that is technically a conspiracy. So I guess it's kind of important to define conspiracy theory, but I would discuss it in the broadest terms. I think here.
And I would say it's important to not it's very easy to have this idea appear around it in our minds of a form of entertainment or a pejorative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that's kind of implanted.
Yes.
And I know that's conspiratorial language.
Yeah, in and of itself.
But I mean, there are CIA memos. We talked about them in Conspirathon, the prequel. Nick and I talked about these memos that said attach these kinds of feelings to this term or to this way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't think the Mel Gibson movie that came out in the mid to late 90s.
Julia Roberts. Right.
Did alternative history or alternative political researchers any favors, because everybody was put in the same group of, you know, this guy running around and looking for copies of Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
So
that's how they track
to be
them.
Fair, there really are people like that.
Oh, sure. There absolutely are. There's people, I think, more intolerable than that.
The Oliver Stone, George Bush connection, Oliver Stone.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, he's their spokesman. Yeah. I mean, you think if anyone had the information that he's got and had a national podium to shout it from, that they'd actually let him do it? No, it's quite clear that he's a disinformation junkie for him. The fact that he's still alive says it all. I mean, he probably should be dead, but he's not.
Can you prove any of this?
No, absolutely not. A good conspiracy is an unprovable one. If you can prove it, I mean, they must have screwed up somewhere along the line, and if that's the case, well...
They.
Yeah.
They who?
They. Well, they... I don't know. That's why they call them they and them, you know.
I mean, they monitor everything, absolutely everything.
Elaborate on they. They?
They. Well, there's lots of groups, actually, lots of initials. I mean, CIA, FBI, IMF, IMF, you name it. They. But really, they're part of the big two opposing factions.
Which are?
Which are? What? One. Some of them are really, really wealthy families. Their one thing is to maintain stability, or at least that's what they call it. The other group is Eisenhower's industrial military complex, and they want to maintain instability, so they say.
So you're saying that group one is warring with group two?
Yes, at some levels they're at war, but at other levels there's the same group. It's really scary. I mean, it's hand in glove, you know, Cold Wars, Hot Wars, then they sit back and watch the whole damn dumb show.
Jerry.
What?
Take a breath.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's important. I think it's important to bring up. I mean, just recently there was a guy, Joe Yuzinski, who mm-hmm. he did, him and another guy, he's a political scientist, but they just did a study that went back about a little over 100 years, covering the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune. The Chicago Tribune was part of the study to be the control group, because that way, you know, just to make sure nobody said, well, the New York Times is, you know, a liberal rag or whatever. What the purpose was to see, look at the letters to the editor and look for certain conspiratorial language. Now, I don't want to break down what all those language markers were that they were going through, but they pretty much found that there's as much conspiracy talk in the 1890s as there is today. Because I think a lot of people think that this, you know, a lot of these conspiracy theories and the broadening of scope and knowledge of them, that the internet somehow opened all this up and made it possible. But that's not true. At least according to this research, it's not true at all. Yeah, there's points where it spiked. Like in the 1890s, the conspiracy at the time was corporate trusts. You know, like corporations were becoming a thing at that point in mm-hmm. the United States. And then, you know, in the 50s, you had the communist conspiracy, you know, with McCarthyism and all that. And then there was Watergate. And you get little spikes like that. But by and large, the use of conspiratorial language in the medium of the time was very much the same. So, I mean, the idea that conspiracy theorists are somehow a new thing, or maybe something that only started propping up in the 70s or 80s or whatever, or maybe since the internet, by this research just isn't true. And in fact, actually, by their metric, it's declining. The amount of people that believe in conspiracy theorists, because the idea is that there's sort of, or the theory goes, is that there is an arms race going on between debunkers and theorists.
I was thinking that because if you think about human psychology, like people have different degrees of trustingness and credulousness, right? Like mm-hmm. how willing they are to believe something that somebody else just tells them, or right. how much they question things that they hear. And so, yeah, if those are determined by whatever genetics or environment, you know, there's some kind of equilibrium that's reached. And some people are on one far end of the spectrum where they're very trusting. And some people are far on the other end of the spectrum where they're very skeptical and maybe you could say even paranoid.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So this isn't, you know, conspiracies long held, long talked about, you know, they've been around for a while, and the amount of rhetoric around it seems to have been the same for hundreds of years, at least in the United States. You know, that's kind of what I take away from that.
That's really interesting. I didn't know what to make of this. And I was even speculating that if you could do Google Trends mm-hmm. all the way back to...
Time. That's pretty much what Yuzinski did, yeah.
That's really interesting because, you know, I said you would find the suspicion about Hollywood attached to different ideas, you know, the Jews, the communists, Satan. And it seems like in the last decade or so, it has really been this term, the Illuminati. And I even ran some Google Trends. Google Trends only goes back to 2005, as far as I mm-hmm. know. Hollywood, Satanism, Hollywood, Illuminati, and they almost parallel each other perfectly, except a couple years after they follow each other, like almost exactly, the Hollywood Illuminati shoots like off the charts above Hollywood and Satanism, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So
that mean they've gained some traction or something? They've succeeded in their mission?
It means that term is being put more into people's consciousness, mm-hmm. and I you know, I could speculate about why. I don't know. But right.
So when you said Hollywood Satanism, do you remember back in the 90s? This is when I was a kid. I mm-hmm. was born in the 80s. I remember there was a lot of concern and chatter about like satanic messages in
Judas
music.
Priest.
Yep.
Yeah. Like if you played music backwards and
backmasking.
That kind
oh,
of
yeah.
thing.
Oh, yeah. That went back to the 70s and Led Zeppelin, yep. I know, was a target of that. And then.
Or even like they sometimes called it subliminal messages, maybe when they wanted to have it more of a secular bent, you know?
Mm hmm. Mm hmm.
Yeah, the technical term is called backmasking. What they did with that, where
I remember my mom being very concerned about subliminal messages in the music.
Yeah,
when
sometimes
I was a kid.
Yeah, I mean sometimes it would be hidden in there. Other times it's very open. Like Def Leppard, they have the song "Rocket" off of their Hysteria album. The whole thing starts off with this lyric that sounds like "Oh, listenosity," and the whole thing says is "We're fighting for the gods of war." It's actually an anti-war message, so it's not like everything that's ever been backmasked is somehow some evil satanic thing. Mm-hmm. One could even argue that was almost a message of peace. But
well, I just found out this weekend or this past weekend, Brian, because you told me that apparently like this band Ace of Base, which was a very popular band in the 1990s, they were like a Nazis, but nobody really knew about it. And if you or they had like a Nazi, neo-Nazi kind of background.
Yeah, I did, like one of the members was in a neo-Nazi band. I don't really like have all the data compiled to work, but
well, somebody like analyzed their lyrics and music, and they were saying, you know, like "Happy Nation" and
The problem here is we could get two hats. Brian and I have two hats. We could put them on the table, and we could write on cards. And one hat we could put Satan, Illuminati, Freemasonry, whatever.
Sure.
And in the other one, we could put every television show, every music artist, every movie, and then we could just start pulling them and putting them together and Googling them and finding a conspiracy theory.
And something would come up, yeah.
Saved by the Bell, Satan worship. Don't even bother Googling it because it exists.
Yeah.
And we'll probably wind up talking about it.
Yeah. You did some research on that, huh?
By accident. I think I said that, how far is this going to go? Like,
right.
I'm on a page right now that is Saved by the Bell is Illuminati propaganda. I can't go any further in this direction. I have to turn around and find my breadcrumbs and go backwards from here.
Well, I think, you know, when you run into this to find the breadcrumbs, I think it's good to analyze the archetypes of the, you know, these different theories, you know, be it the Saved by the Bell ones or whichever. And then you can start breaking down like where each things fit in. You can categorize not within, because that allows you to categorize what you're reading within your own paradigm and not within the paradigm that the website is setting up for you.
Exactly. Mm. Like once you start to know patterns to look for, like when I got to that point, it wasn't like I wasn't saying like this is stupid,
right
it's like this makes sense,
yeah,
but this is never ending,
right? Yeah,
you know, This is the the Leonard Shelby from Memento unsolvable mystery that I'm creating for myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it's how far does the rabbit hole go? And like even that statement in and of itself, if you typed in rabbit hole conspiracy, I mean, it's the phrase that's used.
Well, because we start this investigation, it's like, oh, this is going to be cool. We're going to talk about Roman Polanski, Disney, right, and Stanley Kubrick.
Sure.
You know, when you get to, you know, A.C. Slater and Zach Morris, you're like, how many Evernote notes am I going to have to create? How much shit am I going to have to remember?
Yeah.
How big is this going to get?
Right.
Too big.
Right.
It's too big at that point. And yeah, I have to start going back and refining this down.
Yeah. So if you want to continue with the archetypes, yeah, I think it's a good way to, you know,
so
to
we
be
had,
going
just
this.
To recap, we had the enemy from outside, right?
Yeah. The enemy outside is the first one. And that would be, you know, a modern example of that would be the war on terror. The next one is the enemy within. The enemy within is the idea that like anybody could be a conspirator.
There's you don't a Fed know who, at Porkfest.
Yeah, or like it's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You don't know,
right,
know
who's this person might be a communist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, or like the Salem witch trials is another example of the enemy within. It's like, well, she's a witch, you know, and like, you know, it's just this constant blame game. So that's the second one. There's not a whole lot of distance to go with that. Like They Live, you know, the movie They Live. That's an interesting one that we should break into later on. But that's kind of an example of the enemy within. Like if you have these sunglasses, oh, you can see who the enemies are within, but otherwise you have no idea.
Well, it's infiltration, and it would be, right. I think, now I don't know what the other three are because I've never heard this list before.
Sure.
But even like political leaders might be part of, because you said there's kind of a fluidity to this, right? They can be interchangeable.
Yeah, and that would actually be bringing two categories together, two archetypes together.
Yeah,
because political leaders were have the enemy within.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the reasons why people originally accepted leaders was that they were people who were trustworthy. I mean, I think, right, you know, that's something that's more biological. That's certainly not the case today anymore. But I think a lot of people would still see like, but you're my representative, but you're the president, but you're the mayor of my city. Yeah. You know, like they'd see it as a kind of betrayal because of that relationship that they believe exists. But okay, yeah, that's the enemy within.
All right. So the next one is the enemy above. And this is the most common. This is the NWO. This is the CIA.
Yeah.
This is like, you know, there is this group, the shadowy group, shadowy government, whatever, in charge of everything. And they're calling
all
the shots.
It has a lot of power over you.
And it's specifically
malevolent intentions.
Right. And that's very important to bring up is malevolent intentions. That's why it's the enemy above. And so this is, you know, when most people think like the stuff that Alex Jones talks about or whatever, a lot of that is the enemy above, that there's somebody, you know, pulling all the strings.
Yeah.
So that's an easy one. A lot of people, you know, I think really understand the idea of the enemy above, you know, especially if you watch like the X-Files or something, that it fits right in with all of that.
It could be above like in space, like aliens.
Well, yeah, depending. It could be
depending
aliens.
On the, how the aliens.
Depending on the intentions of the aliens.
Right.
And so number four, if you want to go to number four.
Yep, sure.
Number four is the enemy below. Now, this is the exact opposite. This is like slave rebellions, the proletariat rising up, you know, all these different
the mutiny,
different
the
ideas.
Employees are discontented.
Right. Yeah. Or unions, you know, whatever. That's the enemy below. It's the exact opposite. And sometimes, you know, but like I said, there's a fluidity to all this. Sometimes the enemy above and the enemy below can be, you know, like combined almost interchangeable. You think it wouldn't, but that's entirely possible. So the fifth one, if we want to move on to that. Is the benevolent conspiracy. And this one is like can have all the characteristics of the previous four, but the idea is that it's benevolent. It's meant to help you. And in many ways, honestly, I think, you know, religion falls under this. Like the idea of angels, that there's angels that are guiding you, you know, guardian angels and all this stuff. That would be a benevolent conspiracy. Or there's aliens who are prepping us for to be ready for our interstellar future and all that. You know, they're actually trying to help us. That
or even in some people's view, like the Illuminati, right? Like
The Rosicrucians, maybe more particularly. Like the Rosicrucians were, you know, like they're trying to help. And if you read what they're saying, it's like, oh, well, this all sounds very nice. They're trying to make a much better world for everybody. So that's the benevolent conspiracy. And people forget about that one.
the progressive movement, possibly. Yeah. I mean, those people kind of thought they were saving the world.
Yeah, you know, this is that's really important because, you know, a great book, G. Edward Griffin, The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yeah.
Just a fantastic read. But he'll admit in that, like, as crazy as everybody wants to think, you know, that the creation of the Federal Reserve and all of that is, and it is crazy, you know, 1913, terrible year, Woodrow Wilson, terrible president. Of course, mm-hmm. they all are, they're presidents. But, you know, they were really high-minded individuals. And I think, you know, and he lays that out, that a lot of these bankers, a lot of these guys that met at Jekyll Island, like, they weren't necessarily evil. They thought they were doing something good. That doesn't mean that their actions didn't end up being so, or, you know, morally reprehensible, perhaps. But, I mean, that's how he kind of lays things out. So, yes, the progressive movement.
Roots of the school system, as you've done many shows on, Brett, these people really thought that they were making a better society.
Well, most of their actions seem to be animated by their belief in the enemy below conspiracy, mm-hmm. you know,
yes.
that people are irrational and ignorant. And this was the basis of most of Edward Bernays' work, you
sure.
know, and it was like, these people need to be protected from themselves, but
yes.
more importantly, we need to be protected from themselves, you know?
yeah.
And that seems to be behind the schools, behind a lot of the progressive era policies, behind eugenics, behind Bernays.
Yeah.
Very, very, very common. So they have this belief. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of these things that they say, oh, what a great plan for the world. What great zookeepers of humanity we are. They have to maintain secrecy about it because people are too, in their mind, dumb and irrational
right.
to even yeah. know how to make sense of it. Or like, oh, no, you don't understand. This is like an 100-year thing that we're working on. But most people, they would say, could only think like through the rest of their day. You
sure.
know? There's lots of theories that the Bavarian Illuminati, and we'll get to this in more detail, was actually originally kept secret because of the Rosicrucians. They were only trying to hide it from them.
right.
well. Because it was like rival interests. The Rosicrucians were much more friendly to the church, and that was one of the things that the Bavarian Illuminati wanted to see destroyed.
Yeah,
over
and church
time.
And monarchy, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the Rosicrucians game.
So yeah,
that
so was, that's the five.
That was really interesting. So we've got the enemy outside, the enemy inside, the enemy above, the enemy below, and the benevolent conspiracy. And any conspiracy could have multiple elements in there, but those are the archetypes.
Yeah, or they could shift. Yeah.
Like a shape-shifting lizard?
the whole Hollywood thing, though, like I'm thinking, okay, well, let's put that into one of these five categories.
But there's not just one thing.
It's so formless and so nondescript that I don't even know where to put it.
Well, I would say that it starts with the enemy below.
Okay.
Because I agree with you that, you know, Jews did create, I mean, they created Universal City. You know,
yeah.
they started in New York City. Thomas Edison, I mean, he was, you know, trying to keep them from being able to even get into the movie industry as he was kind of creating. I mean, he was bullying them. That's a whole story in itself. But they go off to California and they literally do create Hollywood. You know, I mean,
and wait, why did they come to America in the first place? Because they were being persecuted in Eastern Europe and they had a serious enemy, well, from outside and above, I guess you could say. There were pogroms, they were, you know, villages were burned, people were driven out.
Cossacks.
Yeah.
Poland. Jesus. Benjamin Warner came here with his he actually came, it wasn't his name. Warner was what he changed it to when
right.
he came. And, you know, just watched pretty much everybody he knew killed by Cossack invaders into villages and, you know, raping women and just leaving basically children behind. You know, eventually he made it to America. He brought his wife and his two young children here. They expanded their family. He had 10 children, ultimately,
wow.
Including the Warner brothers.
Right.
The most famous of them being Jack. So people who came to America from Poland originally, I think, to flee pogroms and rape and, you know, just complete terrorism on and this is, you know, late 1800s. This is even before communism. This is when Russians were just basically trying to systematically eliminate the Jews from existence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they come to New York.
And they're so desperate. They're so afraid of that happening again.
Yeah.
But they're incredibly desperate to assimilate and to be accepted as Americans, but they're not. They're treated as outsiders. They're treated almost as though they're black or something, as the same way that black people are treated. And so in those early films, you get a lot of imagery of like the little guy standing up to, you know, some big kind of like David and Goliath stories.
Yeah.
They actually featured, you know, African-Americans in the films as like, you know, that they were getting picked on or they were up against some big odds. There was a lot of imagery of burning of villages, raids, you know, kind of things like destruction, but pogroms. Those themes were obviously on people's minds. But then once you have a lot of Jewish European immigrants coming over to America, then they're trying to sort of assimilate into American culture. And eventually they do. They're successful at it. So then you have this other thing that forms of the enemy within, right? There's communists in our midst, right? And that was much later, obviously, when the, you know, McCarthyism era came about. But
Well, it had actually two phases, communism.
True.
You know, it's interesting. You bring up some very good points. You know, we watched this movie called Hollywoodism,
right,
which was about how the Jews basically created this idea of the American dream. And, you know, there were people like scholars in the movie who said, yeah, I don't really even think that there was such a thing as the American dream before
no.
these Jews invented Hollywood and went there. And I'd like to talk about that movie in more detail. But most conspiracy theories, generally, now expanding even like way beyond Hollywood, they gain a kind of traction and acceptance because people neglect certain aspects and overlook certain contexts.
Right.
The two things that I noticed about this whole sort of allure that Hollywood has, modern suspicions seem to come from examinations of the behaviors of famous people. You know, like the things we see, watch this person freak out, so-and-so shaves head. What's Shia LaBeouf doing with a bag on his head, you know?
Yeah.
And who's living inside Nicki Minaj? And you know, even just some bizarre behavior. Like, you know, a lot of these people who are so brilliant on the screen, when you watch them just like maybe interviewed on Letterman or something,
oh, wow.
They just yeah. seem like almost lifeless, like they've
a
been
shell of a person,
yeah. unanimated into just like this kind of almost robotic character, like Johnny Depp, Robert De Niro.
Sure.
This, how is that the person that I see on screen? So I think modern suspicions seem to come from this, you know, strange behavior being observed. I mean, things like TMZ, and even when we were little, there was like Entertainment Tonight, you know, shows
oh, yeah.
like that. There's absolutely no empathy for any of these people. You know, they're regarded purely as objects. And, you know, not just by the consumers of this media, but by the producers of this media, by the studio, by the mainstream, you know, entertainment reporting media. If they're child stars, they're often regarded as objects by their own parents.
Yeah.
And
that, from the time that they're very young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that produces a lot of, you know, traumatized people who, because they're in a very public arena, a lot of strange behavior winds up being observed, for sure.
Right. Yeah, like, of course they're acting strange. They've had a life where no one has seen them as a real person.
No, and they're treated as commodities.
On somebody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that's one suspicion or one observation that's really, you know, driving this investigation into this whole industry from modern times. But to connect it to what we've been talking about, historical suspicions all seem to grow out of like cultural conservative
sure.
concerns or vigilant Christian
yes.
concerns.
Yeah,
or
fundamentalist is there Christian.
A YouTube channel called Vigilant Christian?
A vigilant citizen.
Okay, same idea.
Who is probably a fundamentalist Christian,
yeah.
I guess.
So I think throughout the 20th century, there's been many words that have been attached to these suspicions that people have.
Sure.
About the entertainment industry. And I think that the first one, the first concern was probably supernatural.
You know, supernatural.
Even when they started censorship, and censorship, like state censorship, or even just like municipal censorship over film, is like 5 years younger than film itself. Once they started doing like the Nickelodeon films in New York, people were like, this is spooky. This is different. And they said that, I remember we talked about this in an earlier show, but one of the things they said was film is able to recreate reality
right.
in a way that obviously no other media has ever been able to even come close to. Its recreation of reality is almost supernatural.
Sure.
And because of that, even though we don't like censorship and we don't want to censor novels or, you know, print media, this is something that needs special consideration, you know. And this was very much alive and spreading through the 1910s. It then, the next target was that film was used for espionage. Mm. Have you ever heard of a film called The Spirit of 76?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you guys know that story? Movie
nope.
came out. Guy, it was during World War One. Guy wanted to make a patriotic movie, so he made it about like the most patriotic thing ever, the Revolutionary War. The film got banned under the Espionage Act. They said, this is painting our ally, Great Britain, in a very negative light, even though it was telling historical truths. The movie got banned. The filmmaker, I think he was thrown in jail. He never worked again in the United States. I think the story was he was Jewish. He ultimately just kind of like disappeared. You know, he fled somewhere to Europe. He left the United States because of the Espionage Act. And all he was trying to do, supposedly, was make this patriotic film. Now, that's, you know, one version of the story, sure. But his career was ruined, just like so many people's careers were ruined because of communism investigation.
At home, Americans feared red subversion. Congress revived the House Committee on Un-American Activities. In 1947, the committee investigated Hollywood, factory of America's imagination.
Have you ever observed any communistic information in any scripts?
Well, I have turned down quite a few scripts because I thought they were tinged with communistic ideas. They haven't attempted to use me, I don't think, because apparently they know that I'm not very sympathetic to communism.
There has been a small group within the Screen Actors Guild which has consistently opposed the policy of the Guild board and officers or the Guild itself, as evidenced by the vote on various issues. That small clique has been referred to, has been discussed as more or less following the tactics that we associate with the Communist Party.
If I had my way about it, they'd all be sent back to Russia or some other unpleasant place.
Ten witnesses, the Hollywood Ten, defied the committee's right to ask about their beliefs.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
It's unfortunate and tragic that I have to teach this committee the basic principles of Americanism.
That's not the question. The question is, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I am framing my answer in the only way in which any American citizen can frame his
then
answer
you denied,
to the question
then
which
you,
invades his, absolutely invades
then
his
you
right.
Deny, you refuse to answer that question, is that correct?
I have told you that I will
all right.
offer my beliefs, my affiliations, and
here's
everything
the witness,
else to the American public, and they will know where I stand, as they do from what I have written.
Stand away from the stand.
I have written for Americanism for many years, and I shall...
Stand away from the stand.
...fight for the Bill of Rights which
I'll
you are trying to
take
destroy.
This man away from the stand.
Others from the film industry demonstrated their support for the constitutional rights of the Ten.
Are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I believe I have the right to be confronted with any evidence which supports this question. I should like to see what you have.
Oh, well, you would.
Yes.
Well, you will pretty soon. The witness is excused.
Either you completely cooperated with the committee, which meant saying yes or no to the question about whether you were a communist or ever had been. And if the answer was yes, as it was in my case, we knew the next question was who else was, and we certainly didn't want to go into that.
The Ten were imprisoned. With hundreds more, they were blacklisted, their livelihoods taken away.
People generally in Hollywood were pretty scared to have anything to do with us. Whereas before we went to prison, they had not been nearly as scared, and there were plenty of undercover arrangements that were made to write scripts under pseudonyms for a good deal less money than you were accustomed to being paid. There were a couple possible suicides as a result of it. There were a good deal of misery.
Well, the other thing that reminds me of is the Jews in Hollywood, when World War II started happening, were just afraid, terrified to make any anti-Nazi films.
Oh, there's two films ever
made. Only two.
And they're made by non-Jews.
Yeah, about anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
The first film about anti-Semitism made by a Jew came out, as far as I know, in 1993.
Wow.
Schindler's List.
Schindler's List,
yeah.
Spielberg.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, with everything you're describing, Brett, I mean, kind of the reality check of, you know, is this supernaturalism? Is this the conspiracy to somehow confuse the minds by creating, you know, this alternate reality with film?
Mm-hmm.
To some degree, there's a truth, not a supernatural truth, but there's a truth to the fact that, yes, this was designed to kind of create an alternate reality. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier about how the Jews were coming out of these incredibly, well before World War II, these incredibly oppressive situations. And they saw movies as a way to realize what they wanted their world to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important, I think, in Judaism. So, I mean, Stephanie and I were both ethnically Jewish. We were raised kind of Jewish religious.
Right. And we're no longer religious.
Not at all. Yeah. Full on atheist. But it's, you know, it's important to bring up. I mean, that I think a lot of these films in some ways were about, you know, let's make that world where us being Jews doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. The idealized life.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we almost made the same mistake when we started watching this documentary, Hollywoodism, right? We started watching the wrong version of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was a version. I found it on the Red Ice media YouTube channel.
Right.
And it's like the first 2 minutes of the Hollywoodism documentary, and then it just launches into an hour plus montage of all the times Jew stuff is mentioned in film or television.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on for an hour, and it's saying, look at these people putting these ideas into your head. Well, a lot of people who work in Hollywood are Jewish, and, you know, especially when realism takes over, I mean, most of those things are 1960s or beyond, they're writing about their own experiences,
right,
primarily. And that's such a small fraction of everything that appeared in entertainment.
Yeah.
But it was really a distortion, and it's really missing a tremendous historical context to say, this is a conspiracy of the Jews against the Gentiles, and it's called Hollywood. You know, the truth is, and this is covered in Neil Gabler's book, An Empire of Their Own, as well as in Thaddeus Russell's book, A Renegade History of the United States. If they were conspiring against anybody, it was Jews.
Yeah.
Thaddeus Russell called it a cultural holocaust. The Jewish studio heads were committing against their own culture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this assimilation of Jews, we threw around terms like cultural holocaust. Remember that? Is that Gabler's term or is that your term?
It's mine.
Yeah?
He might use it, but it's I think it's more mine.
And why do you use it?
Because that's really what was going on with, you know, Hollywood Jews in particular. I'd say Jewish Americans in general, although not, of course, across the board. But Hollywood, the Hollywood moguls of the 20s, 30s, and 40s were undoubtedly, and Gabler really documents as well, I mean, were not just assimilationists, they were violently hostile to Jewishness and to a distinctive Jewish culture. And really aggressively were assimilating into American culture. Said things that anyone would now consider to be blatantly anti-Semitic. You know, they gave lavish Christmas parties at their mansions, and, you know, they forced all of the Jewish movie stars to change their names to WASP names, and, you know, said things like, I hate Jews, and God forbid I should ever be Jewish again. And, you know, the last thing I want is anything Jewish in my movies. And one of the things that happened, and this is, I don't think I really talk about this in the book, Gabler certainly does, is that the old vaudeville tradition, which was really the dominant form of entertainment in America in the early 20th century, was banished from films in the period that I talk about in the book. The vaudeville form, which was not exactly invented by Jews, but it was certainly perfected by Jews, and they were highly identified with vaudeville, which was quite sexual, body, sort of raucous, non-respectable in many ways, certainly not bourgeois. It also incorporated quite a bit of African-American culture, jazz, ragtime, or very, very large parts of vaudeville minstrel shows. And that was really, so that was in the movies before the 1930s, but beginning with the 1930s, the Jewish Hollywood moguls sort of obliterated that as well. So you don't see really any semblance of that in Hollywood films beginning in the 1930s.
Yeah, they were rejecting, you know, Judaism like en masse. I mean, and this
they were marrying non-Jews. They were
They got divorced.
Refusing to talk about it. They were changing their names to non-Jewish sounding names. They were doing everything they possibly could to just not be Jewish, and it worked. I mean, they really blended in, at least up into a point.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
The first movie that ever had sound in it, the jazz singer that came out in 1927, this was the theme of the movie. It was a guy like basically torn between his Jewish identity and American loyalty.
Right.
Right.
You know, kind of a disappointing.
And he ends up, it's a sad film, right? Like he has to choose between singing at his synagogue or something and being a cantor and then singing as a jazz singer. Yeah. And then he ends up, his son dies somehow because he makes the wrong choice. And his rabbi says, I warned you, and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, that I know you touched on this, and I think it's worth reiterating that in that documentary, it might have been Gabler himself who said so many Americans, their idea of America for three generations was basically created by poor Eastern European immigrants who were born in the 19th century.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that just gets at like how powerful narratives and stories are, right? Like there's a school of thought called postmodernism, right? Where it's all about like texts. Everything is a text. And like the texts that are out there, whether they be like plots to movies or like books or just like cultural narratives that are floating around, they basically become reality. You know, they end up being real through being talked about and discussed and acted out, and people act them out.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you see something like the American dream that got invented by, again, a group of European immigrants. And I don't know, for me, that just seems like, yeah, that was really powerful.
Who weren't allowed to even be in America.
Right.
You know? Right.
Right. Yeah. They changed American culture in a huge way.
Yeah. Even that phrase American dream, I mean, that is a product of marketing from the housing market itself. Like, I mean, there's lots of evidence, you know, to this.
I actually have even more suspicions that I wanted to touch on.
Sure.
We only covered like Supernatural and then espionage. So Supernatural was like when the first films are shown, people
right.
say, this needs our attention because it's like demonic almost.
Yeah.
Well, that, you know? This might be a good time to talk about the name Hollywood, like where it comes from or allegedly where it comes from.
Yes, when we get to this next one, the next accusation
okay.
that right. was thrown towards the entertainment industry, and what I'm trying to demonstrate through this line of going from this is supernatural or unholy in some way, and then this is could be used for espionage. The next label that was thrown at Hollywood over and over in the 20s, a la William Randolph Hearst, was godlessness.
Mm. Mm.
And there was, have you guys heard the story of Fatty Arbuckle?
It's ringing a bell, but tell the story.
Well, in short, Fatty Arbuckle was one of the great silent movie stars. And he wound up in some situation where he was on vacation and he was at a party, I think in San Francisco. And there was this woman, her name was Virginia Rapp. And she was like a heavy drinker, had, you know, not the best reputation for behavior in the 1920s for a woman, you know. There was a kind of a standard that was, so she was what would be a term they would use, a loose, took many men to bed, that kind
sure.
of a situation.
Yeah, we get it.
Very, very heavy drinker and had a series of health problems. So she fell ill one night at a party after drinking too much, and the story was that Fatty Arbuckle kind of took her back to a hotel room, tended to her, and within a couple of days, she was dead. This other woman, whose name was Maud Delmont, I want to say, also wound up having a reputation. This all came out in trial, of kind of connecting men with women and then saying the men sexually assaulted the women to basically blackmail them.
Mm.
So she, at the time, was called the witness who never witnessed, but she said that Fatty Arbuckle raped this woman.
Mm.
And this went through a period of several trials. You know, the first one was a mistrial, the second one was a mistrial, and eventually there was a third trial. And, I mean, Fatty Arbuckle, who was basically ruined by this experience, and I think all the evidence points to him not having done it. The third trial, the jury deliberates for 5 minutes. They come back. 4 of the minutes were spent writing a public apology to Fatty Arbuckle.
Wow.
Saying, we are so sorry that this happened to you. Like, enough evidence had been brought out about what was in the case. The woman had some kind of a bladder disorder. They originally attributed to an injury from a sexual assault, but it was an older medical problem. And I'm skimming over the details of this. But Fatty Arbuckle was fully exonerated by a jury, and that was the only trial that wasn't a mistrial, was a full exoneration and a apology letter from the jury.
Amazing.
For having gone through this. A man named Will Hayes, who ultimately became associated with the Hayes Motion Picture Code of, like, standards in the 1930s, he had been tasked with cleaning up Hollywood's image in the 1920s. And even though Fatty Arbuckle was exonerated, Hayes made the decision to ban him altogether from film because it tarnished the reputation of Hollywood. Because yellow journalists like William Randolph Hearst, who was basically attacking the entertainment industry or the movie business because it was competition, it was taking attention away from newspapers. You know, he used the Fatty Arbuckle story. And he didn't care. William Randolph Hearst was a very bad man. And he didn't care who he hurt. And he didn't care what he had to do to basically protect himself. So he drummed up all of this press and really made Arbuckle appear guilty to associate the Hollywood lifestyle and environment with godlessness and corruption and rape. Even years later, like 20 years later, when Hearst found out that Orson Welles was making Citizen Kane, there was a story like a cop came up to Orson Welles at dinner and it's like, hey, man, don't go back to your hotel room tonight. And he was like, okay, why? And he's like, well, Hearst put an underage girl in your room, she's waiting for you, undressed, and there's like a whole bunch of photographers right around the corner.
Oh my God.
So that's how Orson Welles almost went down in 1940, you know, because he had the audacity to make this movie, Citizen Kane, that was loosely based on the life, not loosely, tightly based on the life of William Randolph Hearst. Mm. So this was a dirty player. And, you know, he wanted Hollywood pushed out. Maybe it was personal ideological reasons as well. But reason number one was, you know, it's competition. So it had to be godless.
Yeah. I mean, so the godlessness, you know, but is that, I know you have others to get on the list, but I mean, is godlessness like, I mean, is that terribly inaccurate?
Mm-mm.
Like, I don't think it's inaccurate. In fact, you know, they were getting away, like, I think they were getting away from, you know, they were living the, you know, the high life. They were getting away from the, you know, perhaps the piety that a lot of religion comes with. The morals were loosening up, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Especially once you get into the talkies in the late 20s and the early 30s, like with Mae West and goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
Make a man blush today.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because I think there's a lot of parallels. You know, I know a lot of people think about the roaring 20s, right, in the United States, you know, where everybody was having a good time and all that. And, oh, you know, God brought on the, you know, the Great Depression because of it. Well, regardless of that nonsense. But the roaring 20s, there had a parallel in Germany at the time, of course, the Weimar Republic. And this was, I mean, they made the roaring 20s in the United States, you know, look like, I don't want to say kids play, but like something your grandmother did, you know, I mean, it was like, it was nothing compared to what was going on. There's a great book by Mel Gordon called Voluptuous Panic. And it's all about, it's called, I think it's Voluptuous Panic, The Erotic World of the Weimar Republic.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's really fascinating because what this book lays out is just like, you know, the real, what could be literally called cultural degradation of Germany. You know, and this is part of what, you know, led to, of course, Hitler coming in, or the Nazis coming into power, you know, 33 and all of this. You know, it's like when you look at like the writings of Henry Ford and some others, like there was a lot of correspondence going on between Germany and the United States at that time, you know, in the 20s. And I think they were probably both seeing the same exact thing. We've got a bunch of Jews in charge. Okay. And they're destroying the morals, you know, of our cultures. But the thing is that like, were those morals just in the first place?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny. The next three, I just parallel perfectly what you're saying. The right next on. Three suspicions on my list about Hollywood, it's run by the communists in the 1920s. Then it's controlled by the Jews 1930s, then 1940s, again, it's the communists.
The commies, yeah.
Right? Same problems that they're having in Germany at that same period of time.
Yeah, they're exact parallels.
Yeah.
Economically, and as well as, I mean, like the solutions ended up being very different. Very, very different, but or, you know, the quote unquote solutions, I should say. But that's kind of the problem is, like, you know, this accusation of godlessness, I think that gets looked at as a pejorative, but I would see it as not. I mean, yeah, if we're talking about, you know, people getting drop dead drunk and, you know, wild parties, you know, and all this stuff, you know, not being very conscious of what you're trying to do. Yes, I mean, I don't think that that's great. You know, I think people should have their mental faculties if they want to have a good time.
Or abusing people, obviously.
Or abusing people, exactly, right. But at the same time, you know, I mean, sex is not a bad thing. Like, that's what a lot of this comes down to.
Right, yeah.
You know, and I mean, honestly, you know, I'll go out on a limb here. I mean, orgies aren't inherently a bad thing. You know, all these kinds of wild things that the claims that were getting made against, oh, this is godless, and so they're doing all these horrendous acts.
Well,
when the
Romans did it, it wasn't godless, right?
Well, right, right. That's the thing, is that these horrendous acts are based upon whose narrative? You know, these fundamentalist Christians, or these, you know, proud Americans, or these proud Germans.
The criticisms and suspicions, or most of them, come through that lens.
Sure.
Of the conservative, Christian, wholesome American.
Right.
Down the island of the Woodbury Bride, she uses Woodbury soap because it's gentle and mild.
Jergens Lotion and Woodbury Soap present the Luella Parsons Show.
It's the lotion that's preferred by more women everywhere.
That girl who sent poison pen letters from Jamaica about Errol Flynn is in for serious trouble. Errol has talked by transatlantic telephone to his lawyer in Hollywood, telling him to take immediate action. The Bahamas Post Office Department is working in conjunction to track down the anonymous letter writer, and I hope they get her.
And here is last-minute news.
Better an actor.
Spicy Hollywood headlines have always been good for business. And the queens of gossip were the original go-getting Paganini of piffle, Luella, I Saw What You Did, Parsons, and her arch-rival Hedda Hopper, regularly spilling the steaming beans on who was Hollywood in and Hollywood out.
I may have forgotten the name of Lutelligen, but as Harry Carey's suicide,
our own Hollywood star, Jimmy.
The public's craving for a non-stop movie star titillation fix was mainlined and bylined day by day by these two syndicated mutant sob sisters.
The girls got so excited.
For Hedda and Luella, there was no better place than Hollywood, reborn Babylon. And their decent, outraged voices confirmed that behind every closed door and window, glittering, soulless women wandered from wicked to wanton orgy on the tuxedoed arms of vainglorious males through a moneyed, perfumed world of drink, dope, and much, much worse.
Possibly blame him this time.
Virginia Hill, former girlfriend of Bugsy Siegel.
Found last night by Hollywood police dressed in women's underwear, hanging from a shower rail. A surprise.
Hopped off my Hollywood wire, Merle Brown phoned to say she's off to Mexico to divorce.
Not so early on his sudden death last night until after she finished her show. It was early morning before she flew to Los Angeles. And she was.
And how about Lionel Atwell's 1940 Christmas party? He fancies an orgy after dinner. They even have a blind pianist play the Blue Danube. As he strikes up, that's the start signal. And off come the tuxedos and Adrian evening gowns, Sulca shorts and Antoinette lingerie. Just to stay decent, they keep their jewelry on. And then they watch some of Lionel's special films. Not many Academy Awards on view.
So yeah, I absolutely agree with what you're saying, and the focal point of this whole discussion so far is that this eye of suspicion, this spotlight, this microscope has always been on Hollywood.
Yeah.
From the very beginning, on film itself, since it was invented, just years after it was invented, it's like, this is too strange for us not to be very vigilant about right. What is happening here. And then, you know, it goes the supernatural, the espionage, the godless, communists, Jews, communists, Satan, Illuminati. And that brings us right up to today.
Yeah.
You know, it's always been something. some target of suspicion or some people trying to put a definition to this thing that they're trying to understand, but they don't.
Well, it sounds like in all those cases, the common thread is anti-Christian.
In all of the... Whoa. You're right.
Because the Christians were the dominant group, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're looking out and they're like, wait, we don't understand this. This is clearly not us. Let's give it a name. And the name was different, but the idea was the same.
Absolutely. And the Jews helped, you know? They did. By the time the Hays Code was implemented in the 1930s, they were fully on board with creating... I don't even think it was just what they wanted America to be, but what they thought wholesome Americans wanted America to be.
It was, because like you can actually read transcripts and memos, especially from television companies like Desilu at the time, that doesn't exist anymore, got bought out by Paramount, where they, there is constant mention of the Bible Belt, you know, the Southern states. We can't tick off the Bible Belt. Okay, we got to be really careful about that. I mean, and so much of the censorship that goes on is actually based around censoring Christian values, ironically, from, you know, companies run by Jews that aren't really Christian at all, though some, you know, were purported to have converted to Catholicism at some point, maybe before their death, mm-hmm. But whatever. So there is a pandering going on.
A compliance.
Yeah, compliance. And a lot of that really comes from, I mean, part of what I think allowed for the rampant success of Hollywood, of, you know, Universal City and all, you know, and all these things was the fact that, it was kind of laissez-faire. You know, nobody was telling them what to do. Nobody even wanted to be there. I mean, California was a desert before.
It was a blank cultural slate.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But then, you know, World War II happens. All these different things happens. You know, stuff starts getting blamed on the communists and all that. And pretty much the word Jew became synonymous with communism, you know, during McCarthyism and all that. I mean, effectively, the government took over the entertainment industry at that point. I mean, and they licked. You know, I mean, it's really sad. It's actually very sad if depending upon which perspective you're looking at it from, the quote unquote Jewish movie moguls, you know, of their day, the Warner Brothers, the Myers, you know, and all of them, and Adolf Zukor. And
Zukor, Zanuck, yeah.
Yeah. You know, during like McCarthyism, during all these, you know, claims of, you know, of like an enemy within conspiracy that the U.S. government was purporting about communism, they got sent home licking their wounds. It's so sad. Some of them died, you know, very, very pathetic deaths when they had really, you know, raised an entire industry. They, you know, doing phenomenal things.
Well, it reminds me of a story, a man whose name might come up more than once in this investigation, Walt Disney.
Sure.
You know, who was not Jewish. And, you know, in the 1930s, it was interesting how responsible he was for spearheading these kind of investigations in Hollywood or accepting these investigations, ultimately the consequences of these investigations into the communists. Now, Walt Disney has been called an anti-Semite. He's been called a Satanist. But I really think what he was first and foremost, and we can explore those other themes for sure, but he was anti-communist. And I think he might have even been a little bit confused. It was certainly a confusing time, and there were a lot of things being wrapped up in that communist label, as you mentioned. But Walt Disney made these creepy little black and white cartoons of mice that if you watch them today, they are terrifying. The mice have these black satanic eyes. They're smiling at you. It's very scary. And he said in the mid-1930s, I think I want to take one of these shitty cartoons and make it into a whole movie. And everyone said, that's the dumbest. That's the dumbest thing. I mean, these were things that showed like before movies.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. And then he stole Mickey Mouse from some other dude, right?
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. No, it's real. He did. There was some other person who was drawing Mickey Mouse and didn't copyright it or something.
The character's name was Oswald instead of Mickey Mouse.
Right.
Yeah. Oop.
And Walt Disney somehow found out about it and then copyrighted it so that the guy who initially invented or developed Mickey Mouse couldn't use him anymore.
Yeah, so Walt Disney, the crazy idea. Like,
from what I've read, I don't think he was a great man. I think he did. I think he had a great imagination. I think he had a great vision. And I think part of that, but I don't think his tactics were ever very good. And this story is case in point. He decides he wants to make a feature-length cartoon movie. Everyone says, this is crazy. This is stupid. It will never work.
Right.
With a budget of $250,000, he set out to make Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in the late 1930s. He quickly realized that it was not enough money to do that. The film actually overran its budget by 600%. It wound up costing like $1.5 million.
Wow, that's a lot of money back then, too.
I think it came out in 1938, this movie. So he kept these writers and these animators, mostly at that point animators, because the technology was new and much trickier then, to get the kind of quality that you see in a movie like Alice in Wonderland or Snow White or Dumbo, which all came out around that time. And Fantasia was right around there too, which is, oh goodness, that's a creepy
one. Every movie you just listed off, they're all creepy.
Yeah. So Snow White, he has animators basically working around the clock, and he keeps telling them, look, I'll give you more money. Once the movie comes out, you'll get, you know, back end. Just keep working. I can't pay you now. And the movie was finished, and a lot of the people were then told that their performance was disappointing, and they were let go.
Wow.
And only a few people were retained. There was some backlash for this. 1930s, lots of unions start getting put together. Mm-hmm. Animators, writers, they really want the Hollywood writers and animators, those kinds of workers, they want to bring them in. They say, we'll help you fight Disney and get what you deserve. So they come back at Disney and they almost shut down the production of the next movie, Dumbo. After Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, he proves everybody wrong. It's a smashing success. You know, they can't wait to see what he does next. So he sees this pushback, which was totally illegitimate because he was an asshole.
Yes.
And he lied to people as like this communist subversion of America, which I will say I do believe in many cases, at least a collectivist subversion was happening, was real. But Walt Disney was like, oh, this is what everyone's been talking about. These jerks.
He read into something.
Exactly.
Just before the strike, work had begun on a story about a baby circus elephant called Dumbo. Despite the fact that some of his best artists were now manning the picket lines, Disney was determined that work on the picture should continue. Produced mostly by strikebreakers, Dumbo made a thinly veiled reference to the studio's own crisis.
300, 1,000.
Yeah, that's good.
In one scene, some greedy circus clowns sow the seeds of industrial unrest.
Oh, they're made of rubber.
This idea is sensational. Let's go tell the boss.
Hey, let's hit him for a raise.
Yeah, sure. This is white real dough.
Oh, we're going to hit the big boss for a raise.
Yes, we're going to hit the big boss for a raise.
Oh, we're going to get more money. Because we know that we're funny. We're going to hit the big boss for a raise.
Back on the picket line, Disney's own workers were not afraid to show the big boss how they felt.
Disney had to kind of run the gauntlet to get to his own studio.
Must have been awful for him. We would shout and yell. It was kind of frightening.
Somebody yelled something out that he didn't like, and he got out of his car and he was ready to run and kind of go at it with this fellow physically, but he was restrained. By this time, his fuse was so low that the spark was ready to hit the TNT.
He just went ballistic about that strike, I tell you.
Came out every day almost and stood there about, 60 feet back of the gates to watch the picket line.
He had someone come out and photograph the picket line, photograph everybody that was in the picket line.
His office was lined with the photos of all the people on the picket lines, and he would go through and pick out and say, this bastard, you know, I did this for him, and this one over here, and I'm never going to do this for the other.
He had taken it to all kind of wild proportion. He had personalized it. It was no longer a question of unions. It was no longer a question of fair pay and low work. It was a question of betrayal. It was, this is the thanks I get for all I've done for you.
The strike dragged on. The more Disney thought about it, the harder he found it to accept that the strikers had willingly defied him. He became convinced that the real truth was that communists were behind the strike.
he saw the strike as a microcosm of the growing communist threat in Hollywood and America. It was almost a heroic posture that I think he saw himself in the Alamo of Hollywood, you know, fighting off these insurgents.
Yeah, really, Disney was, in many ways, I think, kind of getting what he deserved. I mean, this is a company that gives they treat like, you know, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, The Little Mermaid, as if somehow they invented these things.
Mm-hmm.
You never, ever, ever see the credit given to the original author of those stories. Doesn't matter if that person was born 400 or, you know, 200 years ago or something, you know, like the Brothers Grimm or some, you know, some crap like that.
Not even Alice in Wonderland? Who wrote that?
I don't.
Lewis Carroll.
Lewis Carroll. Yeah, I don't know that Carroll was credited.
Wow.
In it, but like the original writers are never ever given credit by Disney, and I think, I mean, that's so insulting, you know, to not even do that. I mean, I can understand why, right? I, you know, I've known a lot of you know, script writers, and all of them are terrified, you know, of Disney, because sooner or later they're worried they're going to get erased from the history of, you know, some really like solid works. I mean, I also can't take it away from the fact that Disney's made amazing films.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, so, you know, Walt Disney kind of had it coming. I mean, I know there's some, and I don't know enough about this to really talk about it much. I mean, there's a lot of theories that J. Edgar Hoover and Walt Disney were pretty good buddies, like to the point that they like cross-dressed together. I mean, it goes that far. Yeah. Yeah. Disney, I could see, you know, a lot of that. You know, what you're saying, the stories you're saying about him, you know, saying, oh, no, these people are all communists or all this and that. I could definitely see him doing that. Not a good guy.
The concerns about communism, especially then, I think were completely legitimate. But the whole HUAC process, the House Un-American Activities Committee that really went after Hollywood in the late 40s, destroyed a lot of people's lives. Just like that story that we told in the 20s about Hollywood is godless, or Hollywood is impure, or Hollywood is, you know, drunks and rapists. What happened in the 40s was like that on a much, much larger scale.
Yeah.
But there were also, you know, you guys have probably heard the story of the Hollywood 10.
Tell me that story. I don't think I've heard it.
The Hollywood 10. And I'll tell this quick because it's not conspiratorial at all. Well, actually, no, it is, because this was
The Majestic 12.
It's all connected, man.
and Disney actually comes back into this. The Hollywood 10 were the people who were basically, they were ultimately blacklisted from being able to work in Hollywood. Now, a few of them, like Dalton Trumbo, were like secretly working in Hollywood years after they were blacklisted under other names. But what happened was, these were people who were not friendly witnesses. When HUAC called all these people to testify in the late 40s, mostly like 1948, 1949, and a lot of them were communists. In the beginning, I think a lot of people in Hollywood, like Humphrey Bogart, were naive, that they're like, oh, this is just, you know, they're just bullying these. And they were. It was the HUAC definitely used bully tactics. But they were like, oh, these people aren't real communists. This is just like a Stalinist show trial kind of thing, which was also happening at around the same time. Mm-hmm. But our government is doing it in the name of fighting what Stalin stands for, ironically.
Right.
So Humphrey Bogart organized this thing with like all of the top people in Hollywood, Frank Sinatra, Katharine Hepburn. And I think it was called the Committee for the First Amendment. And they went to basically take the side of anybody who was called to testify in front of HUAC. And when they got there and they started watching these people actually testify, I think Bogart especially was like, holy shit, these people are communists. And they've been using me, you know, so now I'm associated. And it threatened a lot of their careers. Mm. Ultimately, those people, the ones who got blacklisted, the Hollywood 10, they were on a mission to basically undermine the whole process of trying to root out communist subversion, to make a mockery of that proceeding, even though it was kind of making a mockery of it of itself. But a lot of like A-list people in Hollywood almost got dragged into that and had their careers destroyed.
Wow.
But there was a meeting of executives and, you know, powerful studio heads and producers at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, and they wrote a memo and they said, these people that didn't cooperate with HUAC can never work in Hollywood again. And wow. That was where the Hollywood blacklist came from. late 40s, early 50s. The letter that, you know, determined this from on high, like the most powerful voices in Hollywood say, you know, if this was the finding at HUAC or you didn't cooperate,
right,
you will never, you're a communist and you'll never work in Hollywood again, was spearheaded by Walt Disney himself, who just 10 or 12 years earlier had had all of these, you know, difficulties with unions trying to shut down the production of his second movie because he fucked everybody over on the first one.
Mm, that's really, you know, interesting.
So those were 10 people at least having their careers destroyed by a decision that he was one of the principal architects in.
One of those who shared Disney's fear of communism was FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover.
Communism in reality is not a political party. It is a way of life, an evil and malignant way of life. It reveals a condition akin to disease that spreads like an epidemic. And like an epidemic, a quarantine is necessary to keep it from infecting this nation.
Hoover and Disney shared similar outlooks.
You know, they were similarly dark-driven men. They'd done the same thing in almost the same time frame. They had built little organizations into big organizations. The FBI was a Disney-like organization. All those clean-cut, WASP young men in their ties and their black suits and so forth, going around very politely inquiring into your political beliefs. There would have been a natural affinity there.
FBI headquarters. One moment, please. I'll give you Mr. Hoover.
Documents released under the Freedom of Information Act revealed that the relationship between Hoover and Disney went beyond a natural affinity. In 1954, the head of the FBI's Los Angeles office wrote to Hoover, recommending that Disney be given special status within the Bureau's intelligence gathering network.
Mr. Disney can be a valuable assistance to this office. It is my recommendation that he be approved as an SAC, Special Agent in Charge, contact.
At the head of each of the FBI's 51 field offices is a special agent in charge.
He was classified as an SAC contact, meaning a contact who is contacted solely by the special agent in charge of the field office, in this case, Los Angeles.
William Turner worked for the FBI for more than 10 years. We asked him to review Disney's FBI file.
Disney was feeding a lot of information about inside Hollywood to the FBI. He was informing to the FBI what he knew about activities of a subversive or conceived subversive nature in the industry.
Disney's FBI file runs to around 600 pages and points to a 20-year relationship with the Bureau. But the exact nature of the information Disney supplied to the FBI might never be known. Around 80% of the documents are either partly or wholly blacked out. The FBI says this is to protect confidential sources.
We have no way of telling if those are valid withholdings or not. We simply have to go on their word.
Walt Disney is dead for a quarter of a century. What possible information can remain in that file in 1994 that needs to be blacked out?
Well, why do you think they've blacked it out?
Because they want to protect Walt Disney's reputation.
April 1944. The Biltmore Hotel, Los Angeles. Members of the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals meet secretly with investigators from Washington's Un-American Activities Committee. The alliance had been formed a few months earlier by Walt Disney and a group of Hollywood ultra-conservatives dedicated to stemming the communist tide.
A lot of famous names were involved in it. A lot of them really believed that communism was taking a hold in our schools and in our movies.
Disney and his MPA colleagues had drawn up a list of suspected communists working in the film industry. and at the Biltmore meeting, they handed it over to the investigators. Those named were to become the first victims of the McCarthyite witch hunts.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
It's unfortunate and tragic that I have to teach this committee the basic principles of Americanism.
Are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I believe I have the right to be confronted with any evidence.
Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
It is perfectly clear to me, gentlemen, that if you continue in this particular fashion,
will you direct the
You have only one idea, and that is to cause strife in the industry, chaos in the industry.
The House Un-American Activities Committee ushered in one of the most shameful periods in American history. Hollywood liberals and left-wingers were called before the committee and subjected to ruthless interrogation.
For Americanism for many years, and I
stand away from the stand.
Fight for the Bill of Rights, which I'll
stand away from the stand.
They were out to blacklist and to get anybody connected with the film that they suspected of being left-wing or communist out of the industry and destroy their careers.
The committee's show trial attack on Hollywood left-wingers was assisted by a series of big-name witnesses, anxious to confirm the extent of the communist threat in Hollywood. Several of the so-called friendly witnesses came from the ranks of Disney's Motion Picture Alliance. And on October the 24th, 1947, after a session with Ronald Reagan, Disney himself took the stand.
I don't believe it's a political party. I believe it's an un-American thing. And I feel that that they really ought to be smoked out and shown up for what they are so that all the good free causes in this country, all the liberalisms that really are American, can go out without this taint of communism.
We're talking, in Disney's case, a certain paranoia. Communists, in the minds of certain kinds of sort of primitive anti-communists, are sort of like, you know, these extraterrestrials we hear about now. They're coming out of nowhere and landing in our backyards and tearing up our turnip patches and doing bad things to us, and we can't explain it.
And at the present time, you own and operate the Walt Disney Studio at...
In his testimony, Disney returned to his now familiar theme of how the communists were taking control of the American labor movement.
The thing that I resent the most is that they are able to get into these unions and take them over. They get themselves closely tied up in the labor thing so that if you try to get rid of them, they'd make a labor case out of it.
He should have stayed out of that. There's no reason for him to go out there and give expert testimony against the communists. What the hell did he know about the communists? He didn't know a thing. But he was thinking about us. He was thinking about our little union. Crummy little union, for crummy sakes.
The bitterness felt by Disney over the strike at his studio 6 years before was as strong as ever. And despite no hard evidence, he named several of the strike leaders as communists, including union organizer Herb Sorrell.
I believe at that time that Mr. Sorrell was a communist because of all the things that I had heard and had seen his name appearing on many of the Commie Front things.
Can you name any other individuals that were active at the time?
At this point, the newsreel pictures were cut. But the congressional record shows that Disney went on to name strike activist David Hilberman as a communist.
I got a call from my brother in Los Angeles. He just said, Walt Disney named you. And I said, the son of a bitch.
Disney claimed he had firm evidence that his former employee was a communist. One, Hilberman had no religion. And two, he had studied in Russia.
I found a job at a musical comedy theater, if you please. That was on my resume. I turned it in. Disney, of course, as soon as this all happened, probably looked it up, and there it was. Since I've been in Russia, I must have been a communist.
It was the beginning of a nightmare for David Hilberman. Disney's decision to name him led to further condemnations at subsequent show trials. Hilberman was blacklisted and forced into exile in England.
I guess that having been involved in that strike and been a leader of it, it was fair game. I stuck my neck out. So, big surprise, the axe fell. Walt Disney, on the one hand, a great producer, inspirer, so on, and on the other, a son of a bitch.
Yeah, I think that kind of gets to the point I was trying to think of earlier, because HUAC was the case I was thinking of, where, you know, like everybody getting accused of being a communist, like you said, some of them may have actually been,
yeah.
You know, were. But really, like, you know, we're talking about how the Jews created, you know, Hollywood, how they created this, you know, all of this, the whole entertainment industry in many ways that we know of today. But, I, you know, it kind of gets to a point that I just want to bring up quick before we go into other things. I mean, I don't think they're the ones that control it anymore. I think from that point on, and there's actually a lot of documentation to prove it. I mean, in many ways, the U.S. government controls Hollywood now. There was, in fact, a very famous leak recently of papers showing that they wanted to make Top Gun 2, you know, sequel to the great Tom Cruise movie there. And the U.S. government said, no, you can't. You're not allowed to make this movie because it's going to sexualize the military. You can't do this. And there was a lot of other cases where the military really had a lot of say, just because they would pull away, like, you know, a lot of times the military, you know, why is the military such a big shown off so kindly in so many films today? Much of the time that is because the military will actually lend producers, you know, Hollywood producers, equipment. And, you know, just
they're
make
approving
sure,
the scripts sometimes.
Yeah, they're approving the scripts and all this stuff. Just make sure this looks good and all that.
That's
and
the deal.
We'll give
yeah.
you a deal. And but that's the thing, is that if they say no, you know, if a Hollywood producer says, oh, no, we don't want your involvement. I mean, then your budget for a Hollywood movie quadruples because you're not getting the special deal, you know, from the military or the U.S. government. So, you know, regardless of the origins, I think today you really have, I mean, Hollywood in this might want to be called conspiracy itself, but I mean, now the documentation has been released to show that there's a lot of movies where the government has either stopped them from getting produced or has, like, openly, like with the Terminator films, they said, oh, that's too close to something that DARPA is developing. You can't use that. And they had to redesign the film. I mean, they have a lot of sway. You know, ever since HUAC, I think.
Absolutely. Well, that was certainly a wedge that was right. opened and never closed. A wedge in, and it, you know, I don't even think that was the first time, but that was where things were really split wide
yeah.
open.
Yeah.
And the Motion Picture Production Code that was. Are you guys familiar with the code?
Yes.
The it goes from roughly the mid 1930s to the late 1960s, and it was like this the self-imposed standards. That the industry, you know, I mean, and the government was part of it. And I think that to speak to what you said, in the beginning, at the time of the New Deal, Hollywood was like, shit, they just elected a guy and I heard he likes to meddle in things. And sooner or later, it might be us. And we also, like, just along with the Nazis, the Roosevelt administration understood the power of the medium of film. And they put Hollywood to work, including the Warner Brothers, including Disney, including poor Donald Duck to
oh, yeah.
work.
I yeah. remember that.
Yeah. The taxes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then the Nazi thing. This is a day in Nazi Germany if you're a Nazi Donald Duck. But the Warner Brothers with their electrical parade that was like some pro-Roosevelt Nazi-style parade that Jack Warner organized in the early 1930s, Hollywood did definitely the Roosevelt administration's bidding, and the code was basically self-imposed because they knew the government was going to come down on them. And they said, right. look, no, we'll do it to ourselves. We'll do it to ourselves. And as it went on, a lot of people working in the industry actually liked the code because it made their work predictable and easy. You know, like, oh, well, we can't have any, you know, miscegenation. So,
yeah,
that's good. And why don't we just write the same way we wrote it last time, boys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and it gave them like a working structure that a lot of them liked. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say a lot of other industries had the same thing. The Comic Books Code Authority,
yeah.
which Marvel didn't dump until like the 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, that wow. was around forever. And that was definitely pro, you know, stop the Nazis and, you know, everything you're talking about with the motion picture code. Same deal. Lots of industries, you know, had these self-imposed, you know, it was a private organization. But, it was straight up censorship and it was playing ball with a lot of, you know, cultural norms.
Yeah, absolutely. And then as soon as it was lifted in 1967, it was boom, The Graduate. You want to have sex with somebody's mother? Yeah, your girlfriend's mother. It's going to be in a movie.
Yep.
Easy Rider, Midnight Cowboy, Rosemary's Baby,
oh, yeah.
The Exorcist, and then just, you know, within 5 years, The Godfather, Horses Heads in Bed. Like, all that stuff was definitely not okay during the Motion Picture Production Code. And they did switch to the rating system at that point.
Right.
And they marked a few of these, like Midnight Cowboy and Clockwork Orange, X. But that only made them more exciting for people.
Yeah.
The, you know, the late 60s and the early 70s, when there were a lot of countercultural uprisings. And that's where things start to get really interesting.
Yeah.
Considering our purposes here.
To be continued.
Listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. You'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.